Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. This is one of those empowering hours, starting off with showing you how to flush the toxins away during sleep from your brain. Never heard of that before? New information. Then we're going to examine if you're suffering from fructose poisoning. Really interesting new piece of research from Roman Hartley of Life Extension. Then we're going to segue into what's in the chicken that you're eating. We'll tell you that, and then it might give you a sense of pause. Horrifying Things in Chicken from Martha Rosenberg from Alternet. And also, I'm going to do a little bit on our public health segment on the so-called free vaccines that are being promoted all across the country. And this is the latest on why you should think about receiving a free vaccine. We'll show you the real risks based upon the real science. Also, how is it that so many bad drugs end up getting into the marketplace, and hence our doctors prescribe them? Well, according to Ethan Huff of Natural News, it's because the entire system is corrupted. Drug companies have bought their way onto FDA advisory panels, and it's the FDA advisory panels, the so-called experts, that say, yes, we need this. Well, we get it, but they bought their way on that panel, and we're not aware of it. Now we are. Today, my guest in the second part of our program will be Mike Whitney. Mike is a financial scholar and an outstanding journalist in the domestic and European economic section. And he's going to talk with us today about what are called repurchasing Marco debt and Obama's protecting the banks over the domestic economy. I've invited him on because I'd like to offer up a challenge. Now, here's my challenge, and we'll see what he says when he comes on. I believe that all along we were fully capable of allowing all of the major banks to go broke, to go through a structured bankruptcy, deconstruct their debt, and then take away all their burdens that we, the people, later had to bail out to the tune of $16 trillion. That would have been $16 trillion we wouldn't have had to bail out. I also believe that we now should say that there is no corporation too big that it can't be brought into alignment with real economic policy. So I'm going to offer that up. I also believe that we should have defaulted on certain debt, and we'll discuss that, because everyone is saying, including Elizabeth Warren, and I believe she's absolutely wrong on this, oh, we can't show the world that we'll default. Well, hello, we have defaulted in the past. Take a look at our actual history, and I'll show you the times in history where we've actually had default. And anyhow, those are some things I'm going to cover. But most importantly today is going to be a different type of look at authoritarianism and what it means to us today, from Professor Henry Giroux, Truth Out, and then from Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, Corporate Looting in the Free Market, Everything Being Privatized. Now, I've been mentioning for several years that what is in store for those of us in the United States who care about the commons, meaning what we own as a society in common, is that these are all being taken away. One by one, our society is being dismantled and privatized through a public-private operation. We'll give you one example of how it works. And once you see one example of who's involved, how it works, then I believe that you'll say, well, this is not cool at all. We should stop it. If you don't pay attention, one day you're going to wake up and you won't be able to drive down a road. There'll be a toll booth. You won't be able to turn on your water to take a shower or drink water unless you're paying a private company. These private companies will buy giant reservoirs that sit under states and give the participating states billions of dollars and then reap hundreds of billions of dollars in return. And if you don't pay their price, your water's turned off. You won't be able to go into a park. You won't be able to visit a national monument. They'll own it all. It's already happening around the world. So I'm very concerned. So we're going to deal with all that today, and I've put my own commentaries within these. Let's begin. We all know that we should get a good night's sleep. No question about that. But most people don't. Why? It's simple. They're thinking and stressed. That keeps you awake. They've eaten too close to going to sleep, and then that causes your blood sugar to go up. And as a result, it's like putting your foot on the brake, go to sleep, but now on the gas, rev it up. So the body gets confused. It doesn't know what it should do. So in the process of not knowing should it be awake or asleep, then you stay in this not asleep and not fully awake. And that's not good for you. You need the deep, rapid eye movement in order to rest and restore the brain. But there's another more insidious problem, and that is electromagnetic pulses. You might not even know that the apartment building you're living in has a tower, a cell phone tower, on the building across from it. And anywhere within about 100 yards of each tower, you're picking up those waves. But let's say you're a teenager, you sleep with your cell phone beside you. All night long, that's beaming right into your cerebellum, and that's not good. Here is the reason you need a good night's sleep. This is from Science Daily. It's a major study done at the Center for Translational Neuromedicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center in New York, published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. Quote, a good night's rest may literally clear your mind. Using mice, researchers showed for the first time that the space between brain cells may increase during sleep, allowing the brain to flush out toxins that build up during waking hours. These results suggest a new role for sleep in health and disease. Quote, sleep changes the cellular structure of the brain. It appears to be a completely different state. And this is according to Dr. Nierengard, a co-director of the center. Now, in just lay language, for centuries, scientists and philosophers have wondered why people sleep and how it affects the brain. But only recently have scientists shown that sleep is important for storing memories. And the deeper the sleep, now we know, the more toxins or toxic molecules are released from the brain. We didn't know this before. So the takeaway message is this. During sleep, a plumbing system called the glymphatic system opens up and lets fluid flow rapidly through the brain. And this system helps control the flow of cerebrospinal fluid, a clear liquid surrounding the brain and spinal column. And here's what they say, quote, it's as if Dr. Nierengard and her colleagues have uncovered a network of hidden caves, and these exciting results highlight the potential importance of a network of in normal brain functioning. So quite simply, when you get a good night's sleep, your brain is cleansing and detoxifying. In fact, we've known for a long time that certain brain cells called glia, G-L-I-A, control flow through the glymphatic system by shrinking or swelling. And noradrenaline is an arousing hormone that's also known to control cell volume. And similar to using anesthesia, and it blocks the noradrenaline influence and influences the flow of this out of the brain. So if you're overexcited, if you've got toxins, if you're not getting a good night's sleep, your body, we now know, is building up toxic residues in the brain. Now look at it this way. Think of what meditation, and juicing and deep cell cleansing and chelation therapy all have in common. They're taking heavy metals like lead and mercury, cadmium, arsenic out of the brain. Now we know they're also taking out all these other toxins, and the more chlorophyll, the more green juices, celery, cabbage, cucumber, apple, the greater the flow of these nutrients out of the brain. That's good. Something that's not good is how much fructose we're consuming in the United States. Now, there's two types of fructose, and they should not be confused, because I remember when I was in dietetics class, my instructor held up an apple and held up 3 teaspoons of sugar, and the instructor said, this is fructose, and it's identical. So it doesn't matter if you get your fructose from an apple, or some grapes, or a peach, or if you get it from white sugar. It's all the same. Wrong on every count. First, the fructose that is the natural sugar in an apple is not concentrated. You would have to dry the fruit, and you would have to dry a fruit that is naturally high in natural sugar, like a fig or a date, to get that. Secondly, there's high amounts of fiber. Not just any fiber in an apple, but you're getting one of the finest fibers in all of nature. Fiber that can lower your cholesterol, that can lower your blood pressure, that can cleanse your intestine. It is a phenomenal fiber. It is known as apple pectin fiber. And it's in the skin. So that's cleansing, and that's what you want. Thirdly, you've got a lot of water. And the more water you have in a food, the more easily dispersed are the nutrients within that particular food that you're consuming. That's why when you have an apple, you have a lot of water, but when you eat a piece of bagel, it's highly concentrated, hence more calories per gram of weight versus that which would be in an apple. But then we just get to the process, fructose. High fructose corn syrup, and fructose generally comes from genetically engineered corn. Fructose in its processed form is harmful. It is a toxin. And now we're seeing that it's a contributing factor to what is called metabolic syndrome. And that means diabetes, heart disease, and now the latest research shows that fructose consumption is responsible for nearly 40% increase in abdominal fat, the pot belly in men. It's increasing insulin resistance, making you more susceptible to diabetes, and it raises blood pressure, hypertension. It also increases your risk of abnormal lipid profiles and inflammation. In fact, the highest consumers of sugar sweetened beverages have 20% increased risk of cardiovascular disease. The sweetener is ubiquitous in our society. It's everywhere. In fact, there has been so much fructose put into so many beverages, I would guess the average person's consuming about 10 times more fructose daily than what they should. Now, here's the latest studies on why it is bad. First, it elevates your blood sugar. Men and women who consume high levels of fructose have an increased risk of insulin resistance, and that leads you right into obesity. And the reason why fructose elevates blood sugar is very well understood. The fructose consumption has direct harmful effect on the liver, also on your brain. Fructose triggers signaling changes in the hypothalamus, the so-called appetite thermostat that regulates food intake and directs other body tissues in how to handle sugar. Now, one of those changes causes muscle cells to take up glucose less efficiently, contributing to elevated blood glucose levels, even in the presence of sufficient insulin. And another causes the liver to ramp up its own production of new glucose, adding to the already high burden of blood sugar. And insulin resistance produced by fructose consumption not only produces high blood sugar, it also results in chronically elevated levels of insulin. That's a bad thing. And a continuous exposure to insulin levels is going to contribute to cancer and cardiovascular disease, which is one of the reasons that people taking insulin through diabetic medications are always more susceptible to heart disease and cancer. Also, it's a cheap sugar. It can fill out a product in volume at a low price, so the public is fooled into thinking you're getting something more than what you are. It suppresses the appetite the way glucose does. So what happens is you eat and you're never full. So you start eating again, but you never feel the complete fullness. It triggers changes in the liver, and that elevates your blood sugar. And it hurts liver enzymes, and that produces enormous amount of new fat molecules, contributing to lipid profiles of fatty liver disease. And it also raises a body toxin, a metabolic byproduct called uric acid. That uric acid at elevation increases high blood pressure. And it also creates inflammation throughout your body. So those are the reasons why I believe that you should be very conscious not to have processed fructose in there. And it also promotes glycation. I've mentioned glycation a lot of times. It is extremely dangerous. It speeds up the aging process, and especially of neurodegenerative diseases, and you're more likely to end up with high blood pressure. So for all these reasons, stay away from anything that has the high fructose corn syrup, and you're going to get that more often than not you're going to get it in almost all your soft drinks, lots of your desserts, lots of candies, cookies. Now, there are nutrients. Here's the good news. Here's the solution. There are nutrients that help protect against fructose-induced metabolic syndrome. Amla. Now, amla is also called Indian gooseberry, and it's terrific for you. It prevents insulin resistance and abnormal lipid profiles. All of your dark fruits, dark plums, dark cherries, blueberries, grapes, they all have what are called anthocyanins, and those protect fat cells from insulin resistance. Also, astaxanthin, that protects from insulin resistance. Ginger lowers the bad triglycerides, helps protect your fat stores in your liver, and improves insulin resistance. Green tea helps stabilize insulin. Quercetin, the great, great, great nutrient. It's really high up on my list. Quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. It reduces abnormal obesity and inflammation. Spirulina, the single cell algae. It lowers blood sugar, it improves your liver function, and it lowers fat. Stinging nettle. Stinging nettle is great for decreasing glucose. And then there are a couple that protect against premature aging of the brain and all cells, the heart cell. Carnosine, carn, C-A-R-N, osine, O-S-I-N, O-S-I-N-E. Carnosine and benfetamine and pyridoxal 5-phosphate, which is vitamin B6. Those are all great. So now you know the problem and you have the solution. And that's what we're into, helping people on this. How many commercials did you see? There are certain football teams I like to watch, New England Patriots. Not very much into the Giants these days. Like for them to win, but they're not on the right path for that. But they're, you know, the New Orleans Saints. These are some just great athletes that you're seeing, if you like football. But it's the commercials. Watch to see how many of those commercials have chicken in them. And then watch how many have some kind of pizza or a huge meal where you're getting bacon and eggs and cheese and a burger and big buns, huge amount of food, far more than what the metabolism can handle. But the number one I've seen is chicken. Now, this is from Martha Rosenberg from Alternet. Here's what she says. Horrifying things about the chicken you eat. Could there be anything worse for the chicken industry than this month's outbreak of an antibiotic-resistant strain of salmonella that hospitalized 42% of everyone who got it in all 18 states. Yes, the government also announced that China has been cleared to process chickens for the U.S. dinner plate, and that all but one of the arsenic compounds have been removed from U.S. poultry production. Excuse me. Did you know that they were allowing arsenic compounds in your chicken? They were. Also this month, some food researchers have revealed the true recipe for chicken nuggets. Many people have decided to eat only chicken to avoid the health, environmental, and worker and humane questions surrounding the red meat. Yet the track record of U.S. chicken in these areas is no better than red meat, probably worse. By the way, a film that I am completed, in fact, I was just told today from my office that post-production is 100% done, so now it's just sitting on a shelf waiting for a premiere. Where do you see what I filmed on farms around the United States? Whoa, what an eye-opener. So let's go through what's in your chicken. First, extreme salmonella. 13% of people affected by the current outbreak have salmonella septicemia. And by the way, that just means it's a life-threatening whole-body inflammation. The contamination stems from fecal material on carcasses. That means they've got manure on the carcasses. Then they have poor sanitary dressing practices, more fecal material, then insanitary food contact surfaces, insanitary non-food contact surfaces, direct product contamination, end quote. Wow. And who said that? The USDA. USDA, that's their own quote. To me, that would be like taking a dead chicken and dragging it, putting a rope on its neck, dragging it down Broadway, and then by the time you get to the Lower East Side saying, let's have some chicken. I don't think so. The California-based Foster Farms believed to be the source of the outbreak and has had salmonella problems for a decade, so says Food Poisoning News. But the government has never shut them down, not even now. Now understand, salmonella is a naturally occurring bacteria, and hence it's allowed in food. But we're supposed to cook chicken and other products at least 165 degrees Fahrenheit to kill it and other microbial freeloaders. I believe it should be cooked at 250 degrees for 20 minutes. Theirs is much lower. And have you ever noticed some of the real pink ham that you see, processed ham? Do you realize how short a cooking that is? Do you realize in Middle Eastern food they have what's called kibbe, which is raw meat, and they'll put onions and some parsley and some dressing in it, roll up in a bread and eat it? Do you have any idea how dangerous that is? No different than how dangerous sushi is. Yeah. I once asked people in this radio audience, some of you may have remembered, because we had about 80 people show up that night, the lab. I said, bring some fresh sushi that you got from a restaurant, and I'd like for some of you to go to an expensive sushi restaurant in mid-Manhattan. You know, it cost you $30, $40 for a single piece. Bring that. I'll reimburse you. We had all these people show up with the restaurants, and with each piece, over 95% of the sushi that we examined had worms in them. You couldn't see them with the naked eye. You could see them with a microscope. Do you really want those worms eating into your gut? I don't think so. So, according to Carolyn Smith DeWall of the Center for Science and Public Interest, she disagrees. She believes that salmonella strains, quote, are too hot for consumers to handle in their kitchens. But then it's not just salmonella. We have E. coli. And just because chickens has salmonella doesn't mean it doesn't have E. coli. 87% of chicken carcasses tested positive for E. coli before they were sent to stores. That's their latest report. Now, we know that E. coli is more dangerous than salmonella. Even the USDA has recognized that. In fact, it was one of the reasons that Russia banned 19 U.S. poultry producers from importing the poultry from the United States into their country. In 2008, along with U.S. arsenic residues, all this was found, and it was banned. And you have antibiotic-resistant E. coli. They're found in samples of raw conventional chicken. Quote, chickens raised without antibiotics and kosher chickens purchased in New York in April. So the people who say they've got organic chickens, you can still end up with E. coli. The highest E. coli incidence was surprisingly found in kosher chicken. Let me repeat that. The highest, quote, incidence of E. coli was surprisingly found in kosher chicken. Last year, researchers writing in Emerging Infectious Diseases Journal report that E. coli in chicken is genetically closer to human E. coli than E. coli in beef and pork samples and could put people at risk of urinary tract infections when they're exposed to it because of its similarity. Then you have arsenic. Quote, what was arsenic doing in our chicken anyway? Asked Bloomberg article after the FDA reported the end of all but one poultry arsenic products this month, 4 years after the Center for Food Safety filed a petition. The agency announced that the center's petition to have the approvals of arsenic-containing poultry feed revoked has become, quote, moot after the sponsor of those drugs requested the FDA withdraw the approvals for those products, end quote. One of the four compounds is still on the market while the FDA reviews its safety, and it's arsenic. Why are birds fed arsenic? It's been approved in poultry feed for years. Why? It controls parasites. It promotes weight gain, and it improves feed efficiency and pigmentation. An article just a few months ago in Environmental Health Perspectives found detectable levels of arsenic in chicken from grocery stores in 10 American cities, including organic chickens. Nor is arsenic the only unwanted chemical guest. Looking at factory farm birds, researchers have also found evidence of caffeine and the active ingredients in Tylenol, Benadryl, and Prozac, according to Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times. The caffeine is supposed to keep chickens awake so they eat more, while Benadryl, Tylenol, and Prozac are supposed to reduce their anxiety so that their meat doesn't get tough. Then we have antibiotics. Where do antibiotic-resistant Salmonella and E. coli in chicken come from? Is it important we know? You bet it's important. Why? 70% of all the antibiotics used in the United States are used in livestock. More than 29 million pounds of antibiotics a year, which of course is what creates antibiotic resistance. What's that mean? It means you eat a chicken, fish, or cattle that has been given antibiotics. You then take up small amounts of that in your body, and over a period of time, you come down with an infection. And where a bacterial infection, and where, let's say, normally an antibiotic would help kill the bacteria, now it doesn't, because your body's building up a resistance and it's altered its form. As a result, now you can end up dying, as thousands do every year, from antibiotic-resistant strains. And it starts in the livestock. For example, here's what we have found. Ellen Singerbergeld, professor of environmental health sciences, John Hopkins School of Public Health, found 63% of the chicken workers at one plant have been colonized by Campylobacter, a germ that is second leading cause of gastrointestinal disease in the United States. That's 63% of the workers. They're not eating the chicken. They're working in the factory with the chickens, and they're infected. 100%, I repeat, every single person living near the plant had tested positive for it. In 2008, the USDA caught chicken giant Tyson Foods claiming, quote, no antibiotics in its ads and labels while brazenly using the human antibiotic gentamicin as a standard practice in its chickens. Tyson has been charged with other scourges affecting big chicken, such as cruelty to animals, paying smugglers to transport illegal workers, and violating the Clean Water Act. Tyson was also investigated for bribing veterinarians in Mexico. but never charged. Two more here, or three more. Chicken nuggets. No one has ever thought that chicken nuggets were actually good for you. At least no one I know. And last year, they reported a girl who lived on only McDonald's chicken McNuggets collapsed and was diagnosed with anemia and inflamed veins on her tongue. Now some researchers writing in the American Journal of Medicine have revealed new facts about the mystery meat. Some nuggets that were examined were a mix of fat, blood vessels, and nerves, including cells that line the skin and internal organs. Other nuggets were mostly fat, cartilage, and bone. Only 40% was muscle meat. A few years ago, CNN revealed that chicken McNuggets in the United States contain an anti-foaming agent called Silly Putty, found in Silly Putty, I should say, and a petroleum-based preservative called BHQ. And it's a tertiary product, very bad for you. And after the American Journal of Medicine article, Mother Jones, Tom Philpott, asked Tyson about the wholesomeness of its fun nuggets. Tyson referred him to the National Chicken Council, which says, quote, chicken nuggets are an excellent source of protein, especially for kids who might be picky eaters, end quote. I would challenge that now that we know what's actually in the chicken nuggets. Then, do you really want to eat anything from China? Remember, right now, when you're eating shrimp, where do you think that shrimp comes from? Comes from where? China? Yes. Thailand? Yes. Have you ever seen a fish farm in China or Thailand? I've seen a lot of fish farms. You can see them all over Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Arkansas. They look like giant mud holes. And they're constantly fed antibiotics. The fish are not healthy, but that's where you get your tilapia and your catfish and your bottom feeders and even your wide-mouth bass. Well, China has huge fish farms that are filthy dirty, and you would never want to eat anything out of them, and that's where a lot of your shrimp comes from and other fish. So when you go into a restaurant and all you can eat shrimp, you don't know where that shrimp comes from. And look carefully, not at the front of the box when you buy frozen shrimp, look at the back. Look at the country of origin. And almost always, it's from China or Thailand. Well, unfortunately, do you remember that there were 1,950 cats and 2,200 dogs who died from China-produced pet food a few years ago? And the Asian melamine milk scandals that plague Asian countries. Still, the takeover of Smithfield Foods by Shundawi, the biggest takeover of a U.S. company, shows our future feud is being shaped by China because China bought the company. And the chicken is no exception. Many missed the announcement that the Obama administration has approved chicken processed in China, raised and produced in China to be sold in the U.S. without a country of origin label. Now, that was strictly done by the Obama administration with his full complicit knowledge so that he can continue having multinational corporations in China and the United States who are part of this. And as a result, the chicken will be raised and slaughtered in U.S.-approved U.S. and Canada operations, but then on the other end, sent to China for processing, which is called labor-intensive, and sent back to the United States. And the savings in farming out the labor is apparently greater than the cost of shipping the chickens both to and from China. But no one talks about the carbon footprint, nor is anyone talking about all the preservatives and all the drugs and all the contaminations and all the bacteria that they're going to be picking up when they're processed in China. So that's where you're getting. And finally, let's get over this idea that somehow there's no pain felt. I've heard that argument so long. If you slit the throat of the animal with a knife in a certain ritual way, they don't feel pain. That's a lie. I don't care where it comes from, it's a lie. Growing up on farms, living on farms, traveling to thousands of farms in my lifetime, I can tell you that there is no such thing as a painless death of a farm animal. And chemicals, cost-cutting, outsourcing labor take a toll on the birds, in this case the chickens, whose lives and deaths are increasingly inhumane. Chickens were once slaughtered at 14 weeks when they weighed about 2 pounds. But by 2001, they were being slaughtered at 7 weeks when they weighed 4 to 6 pounds. Today, they're being fed so much, and with chemicals, they're getting shorter lives, they're getting fatter. In fact, chickens are now grown so quickly, if humans grew as fast, we'd weigh 350 pounds by our second birthday of life. As a result, chickens have constant bone disease, live in chronic pain, perish with eerie factory farm-related diseases, and then you eat them. Not all of you, of course, but some of you, and you don't realize what you're eating. Quote, good birds on their sides or breasts scattered at a random fashion in the pen also usually are considered to be dead from flip-flopping. Diagnosis is supported by full GI tract, partially the full intestine, the large pale liver, large abnormal bursa, contracted ventriculars, and dilated blood-filled atria, the lung congestion and edema, and the lack of pathological lesions, end quote. Assembly lines move so fast, you can't stop and diagnose for these diseases. You don't know about leukosis, the leukemia, in birds that can be passed on in eggs and to humans. So the next time you want your chicken, just understand you're getting a lot more than what you thought. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come back with our guest. Please stay with us, back in a moment.
Woman and everything you own. All that is plainly states that chances go around. But if you want to know the truth about it, I tell you what's pulling you down, yeah.
Bad love.
Yes, sir.
Bad love.
Bad love. Bad love. Bad love.
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world who are tuning in now. A lot of people tune in. 90% of the people, actually it's more, over 95% of the people listen to this program now, generally in the evenings or downloaded. You can go to our archives 24/7, download any of the programs. Now the most popular program I produce out of 15 hours of live program per week is called the Progressive Commentary Hour. It's a very serious program. It's meant to take on hard-hitting issues that are either not taken on at all or taken on with bias. We bring in the scholars on the social issues that are relevant. And that's every Monday evening at 7 to 8 p.m. if you want to listen to it live. Sunday evening, this coming Sunday evening at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network, I do what's called Talk Back. No guest. No hard-hitting investigative reporting, that I say for the week, just health and nutrition and open calls from the audience. So that's 8 o'clock over the internet on Progressive Radio Network. And I've been writing and offering up anywhere from 2 to 5 different commentaries per week. I have a major original investigative report I'll be breaking next week, and I try to do about 12 original investigative reports per year, and we're on track to do that. Also, I'd like to thank all of those who are listening right now live over WBAI, because when we were asked by Summer Reese, the executive director of Pacifica, that we were bringing in, and I couldn't believe it. I actually had to see the numbers for myself. From 5 in the morning until 11, we were bringing in such tiny amounts, sometimes $50, nothing, $100. Just this week on Monday, I think for the whole first five hours, we brought in like $495. And I was told we can't pay the transmitter bill, we can't pay the salary, we can't pay our rent. They're going to turn off our transmitter, which shuts down the station. So would you come on in the morning? So I took the progressive commentary hour, and now it's on at only till the end of this drive, and it's on at 7 a.m. every morning on WBAI. Half the program is the progressive commentary hour. The other half is some form of fundraising. Here's the good news. In the last 3 days, we have raised, through this effort of pitching, like Reboot Your Brain, the other things we do, we've raised over $70,000. We hadn't raised $7,000. So we're able to pay the transmitter bill and the salaries. So I'm thankful to the people in the audience. Least we forget, and we shouldn't forget, and some ideologues and some political opportunists are always forgetting this by intent. This is listener-supported radio. And for 37 years and 5 months, I've been on WBAI. The listeners are the ones supporting the station. The listeners are the ones who are listening and telling friends to listen. And we should always remember, put the listeners first. So I just want to say thank you, and also to all the good people who are listening on WPFW, our sister station, Washington. Imagine how well we did in spite of the fact that we had lost 95% of our signal for 63 days when no one told us that the 50,000-watt signal was down to 1,500 watts. For 63 days, nobody could find the station. In spite of that, we just finished a fund drive, and we did extremely well. So I'm very pleased about that. That means that there's still an audience, still a heartbeat. We're going to rebuild it. I'm very optimistic. And for those of you who can't get to a computer to listen over the internet or can't get to a land-based station, we had last month over 500,000 calls to listen to this program over the telephone, anywhere in Canada and North America. Here's the phone number you should always have, because this is one place you can always get on and listen. 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. That said, let's now go over and say hello to Mike Whitney. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Gary. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, it's always nice to have you on, because you're always educating us and empowering us. Mike Whitney, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, is a financial scholar, a journalist specializing in the domestic and European economies and America's handling of economic crisis. He is also an associate researcher for the think tank Global Research in Quebec, and his writings appear in Counterpunch, Global Research, Dissident, Voice, Market Oracle, and he has also contributed to the volume Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. Mike, first, the larger issue. We need to take a look at what's happening at the larger economy. And the idea that no matter what, if it's prosperous, small, relatively small group of about 7,000 or 8,000 corporations and the people that control them, they make out. If we're in a terrible strait, they make out. If we are told that we should be very responsible in our investments and savings and spending, they load up on trillions of dollars of derivative positions that the average American is clueless, doesn't know, understand about. If we can't pay our bills, we lose our collateral, our homes, our cars, our possessions. If they cannot pay for their debt, they simply go to the Federal Reserve and borrow more. So it looks like there's a completely different world of reality. If you and I engage in any money laundering, if a drug guy came to us and said, Mike, I'm going to give you 10% of every dollar that you wash through your laundromat, and you do that, you'll go to prison, generally for 10 to 15 years. Wycovia and other banks regularly have engaged Bank of America, Citigroup, in hundreds of billions of dollars. Hundreds of billions. $800 billion. They pay about a $1 billion fine, and all that's washed clean. No one is prosecuted. They don't have to admit guilt. They get away with everything. We are not big enough to be saved, and they're too big to fail or prosecute. Could you go through this scenario, please, and make some sense of it, of what we're really dealing with? And my final issue is this. Why can't we take the too-big-to-fail and too-big-to-jail people and allow them to go through structured bankruptcies, make them prove their solvency, and their solvency shouldn't be based upon unlimited amounts of debt that they can get from the Federal Reserve, which we, the people, have to back? And if that were the case, then they're running a really bad business, and they shouldn't be in that position to begin with. I believe that any bank, any institution that has failed should be taken down through structured bankruptcy so all those debts can be washed out and let their bondholders or let their shareholders and their executives take that fall, not the American people. Your thoughts on all this, please.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, and you're exactly correct. Not only are you correct in that too big to fail should not exist, this was one of the remedies during the Great Depression, which when they created the Resolution Trust Corporation, the RTC, and that was designed to resolve or to dismantle these large banks, these large financial institutions, and to take their good assets, separate them from the bad assets, auction them off, replace management, wipe out the shareholders, give the bondholders really big haircuts, you know, cuts in what the value of their assets were, and to start from square one. Right now we have a situation where these institutions, 5 years into the so-called recovery, they're still getting their money at the Fed funds rate, which is zero. They're borrowing money from zero. When Gary Knowles hasn't reflected any sort of decrease in the percentage that he's paying on his credit card. So they are taking all of the gains from those spreads that they're getting from the Fed. At the same time, the Fed has built up its balance sheet by $3 trillion, pumping up financial assets to keep these zombie institutions, the appearance of solvency when we all know that they're not solvent, that they're still having difficulty even at this late date. So, yeah, the entire economy has been rejiggered. So not just that Wall Street can make record profits, but so that it appears as though the system is working when, in fact, the system is bankrupt and it needs to go through a kind of restructuring process like you were talking about. Because every dollar that's going into these insolvent institutions is a dollar that's taken away from real economic activity, from the kind of, you know, you go to the grocery store, you buy groceries, that the grocery owner pays the trucker pays the farmer pays the seed collector, blah, blah, blah. That sort of generating of activity is limited by the fact that we keep dumping more money into these financial institutions via our policy, via, you know, quantitative easing, via keeping zero interest rates so savers and pensioners and people who have money in the bank don't get anything on it. So they have to go back to work because their retirement plans have changed since you can no longer make money on CDs or investments or stuff like that. So, yes, it's changed the whole economy, and it needs restructuring. And until we deal with these private sector debts, the deficit isn't the problem. The government debt is not the problem. We should be increasing the deficits. So we kept those 800,000 people public sector workers, you know, people working for the government, mainly people working at the state and local level, like teachers and firemen and policemen. We should have kept them working. Each one of those guys making under $65,000 a year spends their money in the economy. That's immediate stimulus for the economy. We could be up and running right now at full throttle, probably going at about 3.5% GDP, with employment hovering at about 4.5%. And people, the confidence meter would be off the chart. We know how to fix the system, but the system doesn't operate anymore because the people who control the system, who own Capitol Hill, who own the White House, who own all the judges and all the good property, et cetera, are the people on Wall Street. And everyone knows this, which is why there's this relentless pessimism that you see reflected in the polls.
Let's take it. I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Let's take a very pragmatic look. Neither the Democrats, Republicans in Congress, the people I call corporate Democrats, corporate Republicans, not true conservatives, not a Jeffersonian Republican or a Lincoln Republican, and certainly not an FDR Democrat or a liberal, but this new morphed one, the Clinton Obama policymaker, they won't touch the military-industrial complex. They won't touch the spying complex. They won't touch the subsidies to big oil, nuclear, and gas, and hydrofracking. They don't touch the pharmaceutical industry and its astronomical profits that it makes in percentage of profit off each product. They won't touch big agri. They won't touch Wall Street. So I did a simple analysis, and I asked, what would happen if we took away all these major subsidies and tax allowances to the big corporations, and we only made the military-industrial complex the size necessary to support us? Now, I spoke with people who know, people inside the military-industrial complex, and I said, what will it cost to actually defend Americans? And all of them said about $200 billion. Well, we're spending about $1.5 trillion when you take off all of the things that should be included in one amount. And then you start looking at all the subsidies, and we took away the subsidies, that's another approximately $500 billion. And, well, right there, you've got over a trillion and a half dollars each year we could save. And yet we're not doing that. Instead, we're punishing people on food stamps, we're closing down libraries, closing down schools, looking to privatize different public assets. Shouldn't we be at least honest about how corrupt the entire system is by those who are capable of gaming the system?
Oh, absolutely. Unfortunately, they're, through Citizens United, their clout, as far as politics goes, has only increased. So now they basically can dump as much money. And look at the dividends they get for that small amount of money they put into the political system. They have guys like Obama and the Congress who basically go to bat for them 24/7, increasing these subsidies and forcing taxpayers to shoulder more and more of the burden of the debts that they've run up by selling their fraudulent securities, their toxic bonds, and the rest of it. I mean, we're all paying for the financial crisis in dividends. And so what's happened? I mean, even from an economic point of view, if you set aside the ethics and morality, which are appalling, and you just look at it from an economic point of view, the distribution is so astronomically skewed in favor of the rich that we can no longer generate the kind of activity, the kind of demand for the products these people are selling to keep the economy going. People say, well, there's structural difficulties, you know, that these can't be worked out. Baloney. It's simple demand. Salaries and incomes are going down. Wages have stagnated for the last 20 years, but it's gotten progressively worse in the last 8 years. So now you have people who are just barely making ends meet. We're cutting more into the money they have by cutting back food stamps and by firing public workers, et cetera, et cetera. So there's even less demand. This is going to change our standing in the world dramatically. Keep in mind, the United States is responsible for about 25% of global consumption, and that consumption is going down. So what use are we to a country like China or Japan that is completely export-oriented when we don't have people who can afford to buy their stuff anymore? And that's going to change their resolve for keeping the dollar as the world's reserve currency because we no longer provide a market for them getting rid of their stuff. So I think, you know, the change is going to come faster than people think. It's not going to be overnight. The dollar's not going to collapse overnight. But this last little bit of shenanigans in Congress convinced people. Now there's a shadow of a doubt that the United States will support its own treasuries, its own bond market. And the bond market is the foundation upon which the entire empire and the dollar is built. If the bond market starts looking kind of shaky, then we are in deep trouble, and the world is going to change, overnight dramatically.
My final comment or question to you. Some of us, myself included, are concerned that China's growth is probably going to slow down to anywhere between 5 and 6% in the coming years. It's intentionally keeping the value of its currency down so the value of its product that it's exporting to the United States and other countries stays competitive. But they're also buying massive amounts of gold. China either mined over 1,000 metric tons of gold or purchased massive amounts of gold in the last year alone. And they're trying to bring a mixed currency with yuan as one of the principal currencies. They're already taking massive positions, currency positions, with all these other major nations, quietly. Those in the financial world are aware of it. The average person is not. And I believe in the near future, let's say the next 2 to 3 years, I believe that when China overtakes the United States as the number one economy, that you'll see a shift away from the dollar as the reserve currency to other currencies, and which means that the United States, the value of our dollar will be substantially affected, and we have no preparation for this at this time. What are your thoughts?
I think that the Chinese government would rather see that transition happen later rather than sooner, but with the things that are going so crazy in the United States, the bond market was really rattled, seriously rattled, when the Fed started talking about tapering. And this is when, it probably escaped a lot of people's notice, that China and Japan sold off rather viciously their, stash of U.S. Treasuries, because they didn't know what the reaction was going to be. But they anticipated that yields were going to go up and the bond market was going to fall rather hard. The bond market was really rattled, seriously rattled, when the Fed started talking about tapering. And this is when, it probably escaped a lot of people's notice, that China and Japan sold off rather viciously their stash of U.S. Treasuries, because they didn't know what the reaction was going to be. But they anticipated that yields were going to go up and the bond market was going to fall rather hard, so they didn't want to be left holding the bag. But it may have been just a shot over Washington's bow trying to say, get your act together. But, more and more people are looking at the behavior of the United States and just saying, this is not really a responsible steward of the global economic system. I mean, these guys are acting foolishly. They create $3 trillion worth of additional money, essentially, liquidity, through their purchase of mortgage-backed securities and U.S. Treasuries, and then they don't know how to climb down from that policy. And when they signal they're going to, then they create utter chaos in the emerging markets, where these countries have to protect themselves against inflation of their own currencies as capital starts rushing out and creating this maelstrom of havoc. So what's happening right now, and I saw this in the Financial Times, it's kind of alarming 2 days ago, is the Chinese government has, the Bank of China is actually allowing the yuan, the renminbi, to appreciate. So after keeping it fixed below the dollar for so long, so they would attract more, so they would be able to do stronger on their exports, now they're allowing it to appreciate, which will hurt their exports, like you were saying. It'll probably hurt GDP. But it is making itself more convertible on the global market. So they are signaling that their currency very soon is going to be, traded on the open market, as it will be very soon in the UK, and that they're going to be competing for that position as the world's reserve currency with the United States.
Real quick, short answer, because we're out of time.
Yeah.
When, not if, when the U.S. dollar is no longer the reserve currency, how much of an impact will that make on the value of our dollar, our real estate, our economy?
There's really varying opinions about that, and some of it just say what it will cost us in terms of GDP, there's very conservative estimates. But it has to do with the dominance of the dollar. And will for example, natural gas and oil predominantly denominated in dollars. When you lose that currency status and you're competing with either a basket of other currencies or the Chinese currency, and you lose that status, then you basically lose everything, because that is our, I feel it is the foundation block upon which our imperial rule is based.
Well, then we have a major turning that's about to happen in the near future. As always, Mike Whitney, thank you for bringing us these insights. I certainly appreciate it, and I know the audience does as well.
Thank you, Gary.
Mike Whitney, W-H-I-T-N-E-Y, my guest. And I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. And for those of you listening over the weekend, Sunday night, 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network is Talkback. Have a nice day, everyone.
As long as you live, someone who loves you.